Hey, podcast listeners, it's Weingart here. I have absolutely no voice. I was hoping it was going to go away by today. That's why I didn't get the podcast out yesterday. But I guess we'll have to go ahead. Today, we're going to discuss organ donation in the ED. I have my friend, colleague, and someone I really admire, Isaac Tao, here. And, well, let's hear from him.
Well, I'm emergency medicine trained, and then I've gone on to do a surgical critical care fellowship at Shock Trauma in Baltimore. And now I feel like I have the best of both worlds. I get to practice emergency medicine about 1 week of every month, and I get to play in the trauma surgical ICU 1 week a month, and I also attend in the neurosciences ICU 1 week a month at an academic center here in Albuquerque.
And you seem to have developed a special interest in organ donation.
Yeah, you know, I think it's vitally important, because, and we can go on and talk about exactly why, but I was blessed to have mentors in training who imparted this as a real priority, and for the last 4 years, I've been the medical director of New Mexico Donor Services.
Now, Shock Trauma, a place that trained both of us, they put a high emphasis on getting viable organs to potential recipients and potentially just changing the course of their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one thing that I remember one of my mentors used to say, and it sticks in my head, when you look at this patient with a potentially futile situation with a devastating brain injury, you should be looking at that patient as 8 potential lives in that bed. And actually, as many as 9 recipients are actually in that bed. But more often, you know, we're talking about 4 or 5 recipients of organs. And so these folks shouldn't be seen as an effort in futility. In fact, they should receive priority over other ill patients sometimes.
That's a fantastic way of viewing it. Now, I think the experience of many ED listeners to the podcast is only that organ donation folks are an annoying phone call after you've already declared a patient dead, and they just brush those people aside. Maybe they shunt it off to a resident or a nurse. But you're going to tell us why we should potentially think this might be the most important call we could take after the patient's actually either expired or in the point where they have no neurological outcome.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, over the years, one of the most important lessons I've learned is how many misconceptions I had floating around in my mind about who is appropriate to make that call to your local organ procurement organization, OPO, donor services. You know, I remember learning we can transplant the patient who's hepatitis positive. Oh, we can transplant the patient with an elevated creatinine, and their kidneys can go on to be functioning kidneys and get 2 patients off dialysis. And you know, there was a point, and hopefully we're evolving away from this, where the healthcare providers and the folks from the OPO were kind of seen to being at odds with each other, different sets of priorities. And I think over the last decade, you know, we've really improved those relationships such that, you know, we really approach these folks as a team effort. And in fact, I'll tell you an example here is our organ procurement organization does not just provide staff for organ procurement. That is not their sole focus. In fact, you know, they have a dedicated team of family care coordinators, and their only goal, their only purpose of coming to the bedside is to assist the clinical care team as well as the patient and their family with all the end-of-life issues, which frankly in the emergency department is really difficult to tend to when you're trying to manage a busy department.
So they're not just looking for the organs, they're providing bereavement services, counseling, and support for the family members.
Now that's not necessarily the model of every OPO, but it's becoming more common.
So, Isaac, tell us, which patients should we start considering this might be a potential organ donor when we have them in the emergency department?
There are criteria that are for who to contact your local organ procurement organization for, put out by UNOS, the United Network of Organ Sharing. And here in New Mexico, you know, our triggers for referral are essentially the same. And those would be, one, all patients placed on a ventilator due to neurologic injury. Any patient with a GCS of 5 or less for any reason, prior to any brain death exam consideration whatsoever. Also, prior to withdrawal of care discussions that you can have with the family, as this helps identify DCD potential, donation after cardiac death. Prior to any DNR or DNI, do not resuscitate, do not intubate discussions. And of course, for family members inquiring about donation. You know, and if your criteria are like these and they're liberal, you will clearly, you know, there are many times they come to the hospital and they visit the, talk with the clinicians, visit the patient's bedside and realize, okay, well, this is not going to be a potential donor. And that's fine. The idea is to cast a wide net, have liberal criteria so that we don't miss anybody. Again, because of so many of the miss, you know, this isn't necessarily our focus and our expertise. And so, and this is a very dynamic and evolving field. And so who is a potential organ donor, who is not, actually changes, you know, from year to year. There are two categories of organ donors. There's standard criteria donors and there's extended criteria donors. And extended criteria donors, say when you're talking about donating kidneys, those folks might be people who are older, who have elevated creatinines, hypertension, diabetes, and we wouldn't necessarily automatically think of them as good kidney donors. But in fact, outcomes have been shown to be quite good. And we now have pulsatile preservation systems where we put the kidneys after procurement on a pump, and they perfuse these kidneys with a perfusate, and they're able to actually prime those kidneys, so to speak, or make them better prior to transplantation. An ECD, or extended criteria donor in the setting of liver, might be someone who was a drinker. And again, we don't normally think of those folks as a good liver transplant donor potential, but you know, they do. Even with elevated LFTs and such, they may in fact be able to save a life with a liver transplant.
That's incredible. Let's take a test case here. You have a 24-year-old male, transcranial gunshot, neurosurgery has already evaluated the patient, and say this is a non-operative case, that he has really a dismal potential for good outcome, and they're not even going to go to the OR. They say there's no interventions to be done. Take me through how this patient would progress at your center.
Now, granted, in this particular case, you've identified that the neurosurgeons have said this is not a surgical case, this is futile. But I just want to point out that aside from this particular case, our ability to predict futility is far from perfect. And, you know, and so if we treat every patient aggressively, even if in the back of your mind it is with the intention of optimizing organ function, you know, for an eventual organ procurement, you will no doubt be surprised, and you will actually find a survivor with even a functional neurologic outcome. Those might be the minority of patients, but if you approach every patient being without this sense of futility and aggressively maintain organ function, and several studies have shown this, that when they've actually employed aggressive donor management protocols pre-brain death, that in fact they've actually surprised themselves and have come out with one or two survivors. So I think, first off, I mean, I think that's an important take-home point, is that even though you know you may have good predictability that this is ultimately going to be futile to save this life, they should be approached aggressively in hopes of maybe being surprised yourself.
Sure. And that makes complete sense, because it makes it easier in some ways, because if we provide good aggressive care, then it's going to benefit the patient. And if that turns out not to work out, then it's going to benefit the organs as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And priority number one when a patient comes in is to save that patient's life. A lot of it really boils down to the same resuscitative strategies that you would use for any patient. It just so happens to be that once the patient has progressed to brain death, they happen to be some of the most complex patients with multi-organ failure that you're trying to manage.
So let's go back to that patient where everyone on board is clear that this is a futile case from any chance of neurologic recovery.
Okay. Well, at that point, again, you don't have a diagnosis of brain death, and the patient still has cardiovascular function intact. The patient is obviously on a mechanical ventilator. I think one of the first things to do if there's family around is to also treat the family. And so you employ all the resources you have, whether there be family care coordinators from the organ procurement organization, you know, social workers, chaplains, and such, because when we can't help the patient and reverse a tragic situation, at least we can hopefully treat the family and their loved ones.
At this point, are you mentioning anything about possible organ procurement? Isaac, are you leaving that to other folks?
really, there is no place for the discussion of organ donation at this point, because at this point, until you've discussed the futility of the situation with the family, you are treating this patient, and you're treating the family. So, you know, as you know, it's inappropriate and unethical to have discussions of organ donation prior to discussions of what the patient's diagnosis of death is, or what their ultimate outcome is, and you're now discussing withdrawal of care. And that goes back to the dead donor rule, that you know, there's ethical standards that, of course, the patient really should first be pronounced dead, whether it's dead by neurologic criteria or by your more conventional criteria of being apneic and pulseless, prior to having a discussion of organ donation.
All right. So what's the next step? The patient now, GCS3, there's no overbreathing of the vent. Now, our listeners, for the most part, are not going to be neurointensivists or neurologists, but is there a basic exam they could do to get in their minds the idea that this patient probably has progressed to brain death, and therefore call by consult one of the neuroprofessionals to do a formal brain death exam?
One can essentially go through the brain death exam short of the apnea test in an informal manner, because it's really a non-invasive exam, and essentially this is part of your physical exam in someone with a devastating neurologic injury.
So why don't you run us through that, Isaac?
Great. So first, of course, you're talking about a patient with a known devastating neurologic injury, either by history, hopefully confirmed by some sort of neuroimaging.
Hey folks, it's Weingart piping in here. So at this point, Isaac and I had an incredible conversation about the brain death determination, and we went into all the details, but we don't have enough time on the podcast to go through all of it. So I'm just going to pipe in and add emphasis to the things Isaac says, and then I'm going to send you to the show notes for two things. Number one, he's made an incredible video that takes you step by step through the entire brain death determination. So the link to that is in the show notes, and an article from the neurology literature that actually is the guidelines for the current brain death determination by Ilka Wijdiks. So I'd send you those two sources for comprehensive. I'm just going to have Isaac go through the highlights just so you get an idea of what's being done, just so you could do your own exam at the bedside. So Isaac has mentioned step one, and step one is that you've established an irreversible and proximate cause of coma. What that means is there's some devastating neurological injury that's explaining the fact that the patient's comatose. If you don't know why this patient is in a coma, then they don't get down the brain death path yet.
Then you want to make sure that all the potential confounders of absent brainstem reflexes are addressed. So you really can't move on to the cranial nerve exam until you've satisfied these prerequisites, which are assuring some degree of hemodynamic stability, because you obviously want to have a perfusion pressure consistent with perfusing the brain. You wouldn't do a brain death exam on someone with a systolic pressure of 60, say.
Is there any cutoff for that?
Interestingly, there is a lot of variation from center to center. You know, you'll hear folks say a systolic blood pressure of 90. You'll hear folks use mean arterial pressures of 60 or 65. There's not good data behind all of it. And if you were to query the top 50 neurological centers, you'd find there's a tremendous amount of variation. Pressures are acceptable to be able to do a brain death exam, but you just want to assure that you do have a perfusion pressure consistent with cerebral function.
Very good.
So the other two big confounders is core body temperature and drugs. So again, you know, the old dictum of you're not dead until you're warm and dead holds here. Profound hypothermia, usually you're talking about the severe hypothermia range, you know, below 32 degrees, can mar the exam and blunt brainstem reflexes. So you do want to warm your patient up at least to 32 degrees. Here we don't do formal brain death testing until the patient's at least 36 degrees, but minimum 32 degrees. The other thing is confounding drugs, and this is often the case in the emergency department. Particularly, the patient may have gotten RSI drugs. They may have gotten long-acting drugs like anti-epileptics for status epilepticus, like barbs with a 48-hour half-life and such. So you really have to make sure that those confounders are addressed, either by waiting several half-lives for those drugs to be eliminated, or checking levels of certain drugs, particularly illicit drugs in this case.
All right. So Isaac just went through step two, which is eliminate confounders. And the confounders you need to eliminate is you need a normal or near normal core body temperature. You need a normal or near normal blood pressure. You need to make sure that their acid base is not severely out of whack, that their electrolytes are not severely out of whack. And you need to make sure there are no meds or drugs on board that are going to mess up your ability to perform your brain death determination.
Once you've established that there are no confounders, this patient has an appropriate perfusion pressure, the exam isn't marred by any sedatives, you basically go on to the fundamental brainstem reflex exam, and in which you're testing a handful of cranial nerves. So you basically start by assuring that there is a profound coma and unresponsiveness. So you want to assure that the patient has no motor activity related to tactile stimuli. So you may press firmly on the supraorbital nerve to give them some central stimulus. May assure that there is no posturing, there is no motor activity related to that stimulus. Again, you also will provide some peripheral stimulus with deep nail bed pressure and ensure that the patient is in fact in profound coma and unresponsive. Then the cranial nerve exam involves the pupillary light reflex. You want to make sure that the pupils don't react to light stimulation. The typical brain dead person has fixed mid pupils in the 4 to 6 millimeter range. You should question yourself if the patient has pinpoint pupils, for example. Is this patient situation confounded by narcotics or such? After the pupillary reflex,
we'll test the corneal reflex. Apply gentle stimulus to the cornea and watch for any eyelid contraction. This may be very subtle.
You move on to the vestibulocular reflex. Essentially, you're doing your version of your cold calorics, where you instill 20 to 50 cc's of ice saline to each tympanic membrane, and you're looking for saccadic eye movements. The absence of eye movements is consistent with brain death. Then you would do your doll's eyes reflex, your oculocephalic reflex, and make sure that that's not intact. But then you'll test for a cough reflex and a gag reflex.
All right, so let's review step three, which is your exam. So first, you're going to make sure the patient's actually in a deep coma using painful stimuli, supraorbital ridge on their nail beds, and you're making sure there is no facial response, no movements, nothing. And then you're looking for brainstem reflexes, so you evaluate your pupillary response. There should be none. You evaluate ocular movements using both the oculovestibular reflex as well as the oculocephalic reflex. So that's your cold calorics and your doll's eyes. You make sure there are no corneal reflexes. And you make sure there's no gag or cough reflex when you pull and push the endotracheal tube. So that was step three, your exam. And then step four would be the apnea test normally. You're not going to do the apnea test. If you get to this point, end of step three, and everything's looking like the patient may be brain dead by clinical exam, then you're going to call whoever in your hospital is going to be doing the brain death exam. Now, maybe you're a neurointensivist working in the ED, in which case, sure, you might be doing that brain death exam. Or maybe you're a standard intensivist, and at your hospital, that intensive care is doing brain death determination. So go for it. But if you're, you know, standard ED practitioner, you're not going to be doing the brain death exam. You're going to be calling someone up. All right, let's get back to the podcast. And that whole exam, Isaac, that'll take maybe 30 seconds. And since it's just a preliminary exam, it's not going to be the formal brain death exam. If they had none of that, and we're not going to do the apnea test during our preliminary exam, at that point, if they had none of those things and there was none of the confounders you mentioned, you would call whoever at the hospital is officially credentialed to do a brain death determination.
Absolutely. And this really differs from institution to institution. Some relegate this responsibility primarily to neurosurgeons or neurologists, while many others don't have those limitations and leave it up to any particular specialty.
Let's pretend one of those neuroprofessionals came down and their test exactly agreed with yours. They did the apnea test, which we're not going to dwell on because generally ED folks are not going to be doing it. And they said their first determination is consistent with brain death. Is that enough, Isaac, or do they need a second determination?
That's a great question, and and that is something that is actively being debated these days. In fact, a recent study that came out of your region looked at just that question of does there need to be a confirmatory exam, and if so, how much time should they be separated by? Well, interestingly, there's no previous evidence that there should be a confirmatory exam. That simply evolved out of the obvious fear of having someone determined to be dead by neurologic criteria erroneously. But what they found in a recent study from a multi-center study out of New York City was that, in fact, these delays between exam number one and exam number two are actually potentially harmful to the patient and their donation potential. I think if I recall, 12% of these folks between exam number one and exam number two suffered a cardiac arrest. You know, really not something you want to happen when you're talking about seven potential recipients sitting in that bed and a patient who wanted to be an organ donor. The average time that is supposed to be between each test is about 6 hours. But the reality is resource utilization challenges and other things make it so that the average time between exam number one and exam number two far exceeded that. And a lot of badness can happen in that time.
Let's pretend they did have some of these confounders, like they had a long-acting sedative or paralytic drug on board, and you didn't want to wait. What's the role of ancillary testing in this population?
So ancillary testing, some sort of confirmatory test, which may be some sort of functional test like an EEG or a number of imaging tests would qualify, like a nuclear study or a CT angiogram or conventional angiography. The role for those is really when there's any limitation to completing any of the clinical exam. So typical examples would be the patient with a smashed up face who you can't examine their eyes for the oculocephalic or vestibular ocular reflexes or the pupillary light reflex, you would move on to confirmatory imaging. Someone who was on high mean airway pressures or had high FiO2 requirements and was unsafe to perform an apnea test, you would supplement whatever exam you could get done with a confirmatory imaging test. Or if there's any potential results that are really unclear to decipher, particularly some patients may have spinal cord generated reflexes, and even with the best expertise, sometimes it's really tough to decipher if those are purposeful motor movements or not. And so that would be another case where there's a real role for an ancillary confirmatory exam.
Our patient, and from whatever your individual institutions have deemed to be the determination of brain death, has achieved that determination. The patient is dead by neurological criteria, whether that be one exam, two exams, or one of the confirmatory imaging tests. But this patient now is clearly dead by neurological criteria. What is our next step, Isaac?
So the next step is to, you have to tell the family about this or whatever loved ones are at the bedside. And the way this is approached is of tremendous importance. And that's because there are a lot of misconceptions about what brain death is, both amongst laypersons and healthcare personnel alike. And in fact, most folks would say that it's partly problematic because of the term brain death. And because the term brain death itself, to some, implies that this is somehow qualitatively different than regular death or true death by conventional definitions. And so really, when I approach a family, I don't use the term brain death at first at all. I use the good old D word, dead. And I don't use any euphemism like, you know, they're passed or they've expired. I make, you know, the attention span when you're giving bad news to folks, they focus on what they hear first. So don't go on and on about everything. I think the first thing you need to do is to just say, I'm sorry, either your loved one has died or we suspect that they have died, and then need to move on to confirm that. Now, folks will either give you a perplexed look or they'll simply ask you about the inconsistency because they're looking at the patient and the patient doesn't look any different, say, than the patient in the next bay with a tube through their cords on the breathing machine, the same waveforms on the monitor, and the chest is rising and falling. So again, first I use the word dead. The patient has died. And then after a few seconds where they try to assimilate that information, then I explain how there is two ways to determine death. There is the conventional way by checking for a pulse and stoppage of breathing, or there is another way to determine death in the setting of mechanical ventilatory support. The other thing is I never use the terms life support. In fact, I'll say, but they're on life support. They're not on life support. They're on therapies that are sustaining their organs, because life support implies that, in fact, there is something still to salvage in terms of a quality of life.
Now, Isaac, I've been in the circumstance, and I imagine you have as well, where families, if there is still a heartbeat going on, will attempt to argue that they believe in miracles, and since the heart is still beating, this patient has still a potential for a miracle to occur and basically get brain function back. How do you deal with that?
That's a great question. For one, we should all understand the legal aspects of this, which is, you know, the Uniform Determination of Death Act, a federal law, states quite clearly that death by neurologic criteria is death. So, but knowing that, you still want to get the appropriate closure for families, and you want them to really have an understanding that brain death is really qualitatively the same as death. And, you know, and for that, I'm a big proponent of having family members present at the bedside during the brain death evaluation. And I'll tell you, that's really when I see the light bulbs go on. You can explain what brain death is, you know, several different ways, but when they actually are at the bedside and they watch the patient disconnected from the ventilator for 10 minutes as their PCO2 rises, and they're not taking, and they have zero respiratory effort, that's when I think a picture is worth a thousand words, and most of them get it at that point. I should say the caveat is that this is actually, we're actually studying this in the setting of a prospective randomized controlled trial, but the data seems to be quite reassuring. We have still some enrollment to go, but this is actually becoming more and more difficult to do in the guise of a study because all of the clinicians, nurses, physicians alike are really seeing the merits and are starting to have increasing difficulty randomizing these family members.
Wow. It just makes so much intuitive sense, the work you're doing, Isaac, because during the resuscitative phase, when we're resuscitating a cardiac arrest, having family there seems wonderful from their perspective and difficult from ours. But here it just seems win-win.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, where I first stumbled upon this was when I was approaching a really enraged family that wanted their dead daughter transferred to a different hospital because we weren't doing everything that could be done. And, you know, I came in early in the morning trying to have to undo a lot of the misconceptions and misunderstanding that happened throughout the night, and really being present for the brain death evaluation turned a very angry and confused family into a very understanding family that now was on the same side as the patient's care team.
So the family now understands, they accept that their loved one is dead. They understand the concept of death by neurologic criteria. How is the transition done from grief counseling and the telling of the passing away of their loved one to actually discussing organ procurement?
First point is that the two discussions have to be separated in time and space. And decoupling those two discussions of death from organ procurement have not only yielded in a better family understanding of and really acceptance of what death is, but they're much less reluctant to consent for organ donation. And we've had much better consent outcomes in terms of organ donation when those two discussions are decoupled. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The second is who goes and has the organ donation discussion with the family. So after the family's been given enough time, and that varies from family to family, that may be 15 minutes, that may be 2 hours, it has been demonstrated that if you approach those families in a collaborative effort between their physician and experts from the organ procurement organization, again, you have a much better consent rate for organ donation.
Makes sense. They trust you at this point. And yet you're also bringing in some separate folks to show that it's really the decoupling you mentioned is going on.
Correct. And most physicians, frankly, really don't have the expertise in being an organ donation requester. And a lot of the complex questions can be answered by your organ procurement organization. And if you team up with these folks and establish good relationships, you'll be psyched you did, because it's going to make your life easier and everything in this tragic situation is going to go a lot more smoothly.
So as that's going on, how are we optimizing the organs for this patient who's now been declared dead by neurological criteria?
These folks have a high rate of multi-organ dysfunction, and we want to optimize all of their organ functions if possible. We'd like not to hurt the kidneys in order to salvage the heart and vice versa. And really, to achieve that, the standard paradigms of resuscitation all hold true here. Keeping your patient euvolemic, keeping your cardiac output where it needs to be, optimizing your pulmonary function and alveolar recruitment with the use of mean airway pressures. All of the standard stuff that you do to manage your critically ill patient with multi-organ dysfunction in the ICU stand here. There are some unique things to organ donor. One of those is hormone therapy.
Isaac, you know, why don't we take this organ by organ? How are you preserving the lungs?
To optimize the lungs, you essentially want to make sure that you don't de-recruit the patient. You basically you use the same paradigm of care as you would to optimize PF ratios in any critically ill patient. The use of appropriate PEEP, the use of lung protective ventilatory strategies, all hold true here. And you may have different ways of achieving that, whether it maybe it's some new conventional ventilatory mode. But ultimately, you want to keep the lungs open and keep their PF ratios high.
Now, the only difference is we're no longer worried about preserving that cerebral perfusion. Do we have to worry about the carbon dioxide as much as we did when the patient was still salvageable?
You certainly don't have to worry about it in terms of, obviously, in terms of its impact on ICPs. You don't want them to be profoundly acidotic, but moderately elevated CO2s shouldn't be a problem.
Let's talk hemodynamics. I know when patients actually start herniating, they could have profound hypotension and cardiac dysfunction. How are you preserving patients from those hemodynamic shifts?
Well, there's this novel treatment that is really reserved for the potential organ donor once they've been determined to be dead by neurologic criteria, which is all falls under the heading of hormone therapy. And hormone therapy essentially is high-dose steroid drips and high-dose thyroxine T4 drips. And the idea here being that with brain death, your HPA axis is completely cut off, and so the patient is suffering from a profound endocrinopathy. And while there are several mechanisms for these drugs postulated, essentially you're repleting the hormones that keep their cardiovascular function intact. And so many OPOs have employed strategies and protocols for anybody with hemodynamic dysfunction or sometimes anybody who is a candidate to be a heart donor to put these folks on hormone therapy.
So you mentioned high dose steroids. You mentioned T4, and I know T4 has a long onset of action, and some folks are actually giving T3, correct, Isaac?
That's correct.
Still doing all the stuff you'd do for a normal patient with shock, which is fluids, vasopressors, and inotropes.
Yeah. Again, all your paradigms of care for general resuscitation and general maintenance of multi-organ dysfunction stand here for the organ donor. It just happens to be it's a little more challenging for the organ donor because you're really trying to optimize every organ for potential transplantation.
All right. Is there anything specific for kidneys or liver that we should be worrying about?
Certainly maintaining euvolemia, not starting other nephrotoxic drugs that might be unnecessary. The other thing, which pertains both to hemodynamics and renal function alike, is anticipating and treating DI. Diabetes insipidus for the same reasons, because now these patients no longer have perfusion of their pituitary and hypothalamus. DI is quite common in these patients. And so when the patient all of a sudden puts out 600 cc's of dilute-looking urine, sure, one of the reasons may be because they're responding to your early aggressive resuscitation, but really what needs to be done is to recheck your serum sodium, your urine spec grav and such, and assure that this patient is not DI. And if they are, of course, then you start either desmopressin or your vasopressin drips.
Sure. And if the patient needs to be on multiple pressors, it's not a bad idea if you start seeing that dilute urine to make sure one of them is vasopressin.
Absolutely. And for that reason, it's typically our first or second line pressor agent in potential organ donors. Another thing to anticipate in potential organ donors with severe TBI, particularly with penetrating TBI, is the ongoing blood loss and coagulopathy associated with this pathology. And there's actually several reports in the literature aggressively treating these folks with factor concentrate in addition to FFB and vitamin K and such to get a hold of the hemorrhage.
Any final thoughts or things you want to get across to the listeners?
I think at first pass to the emergency physician, it sounds like something that really doesn't apply to them. But I hope through strategies of the right words to use when talking to the family, the right way to be aggressive, and anticipating and treating multi-organ dysfunction, again, you should look at these folks as seven potential lives in that bed.
All right, folks, that's all. And I will talk to you very soon.